speaker turned on here. We'll come back to this as we need to, because this is the core. So you can see why I say appoint a power of attorney. I know I don't want my father making decisions for me. Now he could say, no, I'm not doing it, refuse, and it would go to the next one, which would turn down to be my siblings. I know they would make a good decision for me, but I know it would be very difficult for them to all get together. It would, they'd go about 20 different directions before they'd come together to make the decision that I want made. It just makes it so much more convincing that I will get the decisions made that I want if I've appointed somebody to do that for me. So what does your substitute decision maker do? They make healthcare and personal care decisions on your behalf. They only make decisions when you cannot. Don't worry that they'll be out there telling the doctor, don't do this, do that, don't do this. Only they can do that only when you cannot do that. They have to make the decisions the way you would have made them. They have to understand your wishes, values, and beliefs, know what you have expressed to them in the past as what's important, and act in your best interest. I had another elderly patient, a man who had had he was in his 70s, had a massive stroke, couldn't speak, he would never recover, it was permanent damage. Couldn't speak, couldn't hear, couldn't eat, couldn't sit up, couldn't do any normal body functions without mechanical devices. He was on a breathing machine, a feeding tube. To get him up in a chair, we had to use mechanical lifters. He could not do anything and never would be able to do anything. He had a wife, and we would say to her, is this what your husband would want? And she said, no, he would never have wanted this. This is against everything he ever said he wanted. So we'd say, why are we doing this? Her answer still gives me chills. Her answer, why are we doing this? Because I want it. I want my husband kept alive. Is she legally right? Yes. She is his substitute decision maker. She makes decisions for him. Is she morally right? No, absolutely not. She worked against what he had expressed and what his best interest was. We kept that man alive for 2 years. Artificially for 2 years because she said so. The other side of that coin, I had another, just before I retired actually, I had the most lovely family. The husband had cancer, but it had progressed very rapidly. So all of a sudden he was in a crisis, ended up in our unit on life support again. A couple of days into his treatment, I was talking with his wife and said, is this what your husband would want? And she said, no. When he got his diagnosis of cancer, he was a businessman. He liked things structured and organized. He called the whole family together for a formal meeting. He said, here's my diagnosis, here's what I'll do about it, here's what I won't do about it. And that was it. And the whole family agreed because that's what he said he wanted. That's all that matters. They didn't like the idea of losing him, but it was what he wanted. And she said, he said, no life support. And I said, why are we doing this then? She said, it was so sad. She said, when he came to emerge and the doctor said to me, I need to put him on life support to keep him alive, is that what you want? And she said, yes, because she couldn't say no. She said, I couldn't make the word come out of my mouth, even though I knew that's what he wanted. So I said, well, did he write anything down for you? Did he write his wishes down? She said, oh, yes. She said, he wrote us a big long letter. He's got it all written down for us. She went home, got that piece of paper, she came back, her and I sat there, we went through this, this, and this. He said, do this, don't do this. Here's him. This is now him talking. We can't take consent from that piece of paper, but his wife could take guidance so she knew what to say. So the decision was stop life support and let him be at peace, which is what he said he wanted. Physically, when she brought in that piece of paper from him, which is now his words, I physically could see her, just that weight coming off of her shoulders. So that man was on life support for 2 days against his will. The other one was for 2 years against his will, courtesy of the wives, doing or not doing what the loved one had asked them to do. So you must act in this person's best interest. What do you need to act as a substitute decision maker? You need to be capable of understanding. If you've got dementia yourself, you can't make decisions for somebody else who has dementia. And as we get older, even if you've appointed a power of attorney, and it's your spouse, and they've developed dementia, and you just kind of forgot to go back and change, or you've already developed dementia and can't go back and change your power of attorney, that's why you have an alternate. And then they would step in. Must be 16 years of age. There cannot be a court order preventing you from contact with this person. You must be available. In this day and age, everybody's available. I've talked to people in Europe. You can talk by telephone, by emails, by text, by Skype. Any way that you can communicate is fine. When my mother became ill, I was actually on vacation in Mexico. My father said, I just can't make decisions about my wife of 65 years. I can't make decisions. Somebody else has to do it. So my brother and I were the next POAs. We were the alternates. He was there. I was available by email, a couple phone calls. I was involved. We could make decisions together, even though I was far away. Just being available is easy now. You must be willing. So again, there my father said, I'm not willing. I'm not doing this. He was appointed as power of attorney, but at the time he said, I just can't do it. So that's okay. If you can't do it, you can't do it. Go to the alternate. The kinds of decisions you'll have to make are long-term care placement, healthcare, like accepting or refusing tests, procedures, and surgeries, beginning or withdrawing life-prolonging measures. Who will provide medical care? Will you go to a retirement home? Will you stay in your home and have care come in? Speaking with the healthcare professionals, admitting and discharging from medical facilities, setting up care at home if that's what's needed, and reviewing medical information with the medical staff. You'll look at personal assistance services. Who's going to come and look after mom or dad when they need it? This is why I say, if you've got three kids and you've only appointed one, the other two are saying, good for you. These are difficult decisions to make. And that's why we ask you to express your wishes so your family knows what to decide when the time should come. So in Ontario, advanced care planning does not need to be in writing, but I do strongly encourage you to write down your wishes. When your family is faced with a crisis, like that wife of the man with cancer was faced with a crisis and just couldn't say no, don't treat him, he had written it down, and that was her blessing at the end of it. That was her comfort to say, this isn't me saying it, this is him saying it. He told me this. We do not have such a thing as a living will. In Ontario, it's an expression we use, but there is no such thing. Consent has to come from a person. You cannot hand over that piece of paper that says, do not resuscitate, to the doctor. He can't follow that. I could write out a piece of paper right now and said, never do CPR on me. But I'm standing here, I choke on a peanut. You can clear that peanut, but that is technically CPR. Of course I would want CPR in that case. So you don't know that you can't give an informed consent to a piece of paper. The paper can't ask questions back and forth. But like I say, I do encourage you to write out your wishes and let your loved ones have that. One of the other ladies who does these presentations is an only child. Her parents have both passed away. She was power of attorney for both. They had both written out their wishes very clearly. She said years later, she'll pull out that piece of paper when she gets feeling blue and say, did I do the right thing? And she'll pull it out and say, I did this, I did this, I did this. Fine, put the paper away, feeling better again, knowing she did what mom and dad asked her to do. The most recent wishes you express are the wishes that will be followed. No matter what you said, if I said before, don't ever do CPR on me, and now I'm saying, oh, please, please keep me alive at any cost, now is what you follow, the current wishes. Even if the previous wishes were written down and now I'm telling you verbally, you follow the most recent wishes. I talk a lot about end of life because, quite frankly, the decisions you're going to make for someone else or that someone else will make for you often are about end of life. Usually we can make our own decisions up to that point. And if we're lucky, we get to make decisions even at end of life. But we're not always all that lucky. And as I say, it's not about living wills. There is no such thing. Advanced directives. When someone's admitted to a retirement facility or a nursing home, they're asked to fill out an advanced directive. It's a directive. It's not a contract or law. You'll be asked to say, do you want CPR? Do you want to go to the hospital if you become ill? And if you say no to all that, well, you fall and break your hip. Well, to get pain control, you need to go to the hospital. So yes, I'd want to go to the hospital for that. But if I'm going into heart failure, no, I'd rather just stay here with the people I know looking after me. So again, that's why that piece of paper can't give a consent. Need to have conversations with the person that's going to make decisions for you. That person must, morally must, make decisions the way you would have made them and the way you've expressed to them that you would like them made. They'll know what your wishes are if you share your wishes, values, and beliefs in advance. And it, you can't make up a list really saying, I don't ever want CPR, because again, if I choke on a peanut now, yes, I want CPR. I never want to be put on life support. Okay, I don't want to be on life support for 2 years, but what if I have surgery and I just need, I'm not waking up from the anesthetic, I need a day or two on a breathing machine. That's life support. But I said no life support. Yes, I would want life support for 2 days if it would make me better to go home at the end of it. No, I don't want it for 2 years. So that's where that piece of paper isn't an easy thing to deal with. These are the conversations that are worth having. I'm just going to skip through these videos. How do you bring up this conversation? You're going to go home and talk to who your family, who you say your family is. How are you going to bring up the conversation? Chances are, as we age, our loved ones have been sitting there thinking, geez, I wish Aunt Lynn would talk to me about this so I know what to do, or geez, I wish Mom would talk to me so that I know what to do, but I don't know how to bring it up. So if maybe Mom comes and brings it up to them, chances are they've just been sitting waiting. A lot of people will say to me, I've tried to talk to my son about this and he just won't listen. I want him to be my power of attorney, but he won't listen to me when I try to talk. Is he a good power of attorney for you? You might want to look at somebody else. It might be a friend that will listen to you and be willing to take on that role.
So I think.
So how do you start the conversation? I need your help with something. I was thinking about what happened. This is a great one. When somebody else has a crisis in healthcare that you know, talk about that person. I was thinking about what happened to that person, and it made me realize, what if something like that happened to me? I was at a workshop today, and this bossy lady told me I have to come home and talk to you. Do it. Use me. Of all the handouts here, there's a couple of really good. This one, this worksheet, we just started using recently. It is the best tool. It asks you questions to make you think, what would you want if? It's things like, the person you can talk to about anything is, the person I would tell first that I'm sick is, the person I would tell last that I'm sick is. Things like that, it just makes you think about, and it helps you decide who do you want as your power of attorney. This is another great little tool. There's tons of these. Take lots of them and give them out to everybody. Put them on the table at Easter dinner. You write on the back of it who your substitute decision maker is. Not who your next of kin is, who your substitute decision maker is. It may be the same person, but if we want to know, the hospital should be calling your substitute decision maker, not necessarily just your next of kin. So that's a great tool to start a conversation. I filled this out. I'd like to put your name on it. Are you okay being my substitute decision maker and hopefully legally power of attorney? Oh, back to power of attorney. How do you create a power of attorney? You can go to a lawyer, and usually if you go to do your will, they'll do the power of attorney for property, legal, personal care, and your will all at once in a package and charge you for it. It's not cheap. It's if you have any complications in your life that you think somebody might dispute and say, no, Mom wasn't in her right mind when she did that. No, my brother put her under duress trying to get more out of her than what I would get. If you think there's complications in your life, go to the lawyer and do it. If you want to just do it quick and simple and 100% legal and 100% free, go to Google, type in power of attorney for personal care in Ontario. Did you do it? You've done it, good for you. You get a 2-page form. It gives you instructions on how to fill it out, who needs to sign it to make it legal, and that's all you need to do. You can write some of your wishes down if you want, but it's 100% legal and 100% free. When your loved one comes to the hospital and you're the power of attorney, take that piece of paper with you to show, yes, I'm the power of attorney, here's the paper. Never give away your original copy though. Photocopy it and give the nurses that photocopy. We used to always like to keep that on the chart just to know who we were talking to. What I do, because I'm power of attorney for my dad, it's he went to the lawyer and got like the 12-page document that says so. I'm not carrying that around with me. I put it in, my iPad is glued to my hip if he's in the hospital. I put it on a PDF and put it in my iPad. It's there. I can pull it up quickly and show it to them, and it's good. It's all set to go. Do not lock that piece of paper in your safety deposit box, because the person cannot get into your safety deposit box to get it until the power of attorney for property says so. Your power of attorney for property and personal care, as I said, are totally different. It may be the same person. It may be two different people. Pick the one for property that will look after business, that's got the business mind, that will get the bills paid, will get the car looked after, will get the house looked after. The one for personal care is the one that will make those health care decisions the way you want them, not the one that's going to be wishy-washy and want to think for 3 days before making a decision. They might have to work together if you have to go to a nursing home. The power of attorney for personal care says, okay, this is the nursing home I've chosen for mom or dad. That's great. The power of attorney for property says, I like that one too, but we don't have the money for that. We're going to have to go to plan B now. So that's when they might have to work together. So what are some of the things that you need to talk about? Oh, sorry, I do want to go through this video. This video just shows you that it's not, as I said, it's not all about end of life. A big part of the time your decisions would be about end of life. This guy is a surgeon, but he just hits the nail on the head for the things that you need to think about and talk to your family about. It's about a 3-minute video, so it'll be quick.
These are hard conversations. I've blown them many times myself. I've not known what to do. And with this study coming out from the Mass General where the patients had seen a palliative care physician, I realized that the gain they'd gotten was that really they'd seen 6 people who knew how to, that's the staff at Mass General for palliative care, that they'd seen one of these 6 people who knew how to talk to them about the end of life. And so what I did was I went to those doctors and just said, I'm really bad at this. If you had to make a little list for me of what it is that I should talk about with people facing these problems, what would you put on that list? One of the doctors that I spoke to was a palliative care physician at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute named Susan Block. And Susan encapsulated what I thought the best for me, at least in a way that I could use. She said that there were 4 things that she has as a little mental list in her head that she wants to talk about with the patient who's terminally ill. Number 1, do they know their prognosis? Number 2, what are their fears about what is to come? Number 3, what are their goals? What would they like to do as time runs short? And 4th, what are the trade-offs they're willing to make? How much suffering are they willing to go through for the sake of the possibility of added time? That list was really interesting to me. It was not a list asking, do you want a ventilator or do you not want a ventilator as you come to the end? Do you want your heart shocked? Do you not want your heart shocked? Her point was, if you tell me the answers to those questions, I can make a recommendation to you that says, you would not want this toward the end if these are your goals. Our misconception is that the conversation is about hard choices. Really, it's a conversation about asking people about what they want to look forward to as time runs short and what they fear the most. And the second misconception is that that arriving at what we want at the end is a kind of epiphany. Sign here, do you want hospice, do you not want hospice? It's not an epiphany, it's a process. It's a series of conversations and ups and downs as we go through a very hard series of sequence of things that happen to you as you become ill and have things come to an end.
What I like with that is that he talks about, what are your values? What do you think you would trade off? If you know that you can't have this treatment, it's not going to help you, what would you like to do instead? What would give you peace? And that's how you can decide. Like you said, it's not about, do you want a ventilator? You can't predict that ahead. But if your decision maker knows what your values are, they'll know how to make those decisions. This is from a book written by that same surgeon, and it's the best quote. I'm willing to undergo almost anything as long as I can still watch football on television and eat chocolate ice cream. And that sounds so simple, but it tells me so much. So now, when you've reached the point that you can no longer eat, then what would you want? Would you want a tube feeding? Would you want to end up in a hospital? If you can't sit up and follow a football game, which that eliminates me because I can't follow it now anyway. But if you can't do those simple, meaningful things, then what? What would be the alternate? Your decisions when you talk to your loved ones can be as simple as, if I can no longer make decisions for myself, do nothing to prolong my life. Or people will go to the very opposite extreme. If I have a heartbeat, keep it beating. I'm alive. Mm-hmm. Where are you? There's people at both ends of that. Where are you? This is the time you get to be self-centered. We're taught, especially in church, not to be self-centered. It's not about me, me, me. It is about me, me, me in this case. What do I want? And I ask you to follow my wishes, because that is how I've lived, that I want my life to go on as I want it. So what are your football and ice cream must-haves? What are some non-medical facts? Forget that you're sick. What do you want to be having a good day, to think that you would describe yourself as having an okay day today? What are your goals for today? When we become chronically ill, we no longer have that long-term goal that I'm going to go on a round-the-world cruise. Maybe today I just want to get up and put on some nail polish. That might be my goal for today. It could be as simple as that. What fears do you have? Are you afraid that you won't get enough pain medication? Are you afraid that you'll have too many procedures forced upon you? What kind of things do you not want to have done? What habits and hobbies make your life worth living? What's a good day for you? What matters about being alive? And the biggest thing, do you want to focus on quality of life or quantity of life? Everybody has a different answer, and that's when I say it's me, me, me. I get to say what I want in these cases. Quality of life is hard to define, but we sure know when we don't have it. You go along being sick, and all of a sudden you realize this isn't what I signed on for. Then do I need to change direction in my care? There's another wonderful quote that says, we're all going to die someday, but all the other days we aren't going to die. So what about all those other days? Yes, we need to discuss what's important at our end of our life, but what about what's important when we're alive and still here and doing things? What are the benefits of advanced care planning? There are so many benefits. First of all, you improve the patient and family satisfaction with care. That wife who physically, her shoulders came up because the weight and the burden was taken off of her by her husband saying what he wanted for him, not her being forced to make those decisions. So you decrease that caregiver distress and trauma that they have to go through. You decrease unwanted investigations, tests, and procedures. With my dad again, we have a strong history of bowel cancer in our family, so his doctor, being a wonderful doctor, had told him all the things he should be offering him for health care, suggested at 94, I think, years of age, that he should have a colonoscopy because of this history of bowel cancer. If you've had a colonoscopy, do you want to be 94 years old having a colonoscopy prep? So Dad turned to me for help with his decision, and I said, what will you do if they find a tumor? Nothing. Will you have surgery? No. Will you have chemo? No. Will you have radiation? No. Do you want the test? No. Simple as that. If you're not going to deal with the results, why have the test? Why spend the money, which you don't want to think about just money, but why put yourself through something you don't want? Let's go out and have an ice cream instead of a bowel prep. The patient is more likely to die where they want to be. They might end up at home with care, in hospice with hospice care, or in a hospital if that's the preference for them. More likely to get into palliative care sooner. Palliative care doesn't just mean the end of your life. It's leading towards end of life. But working with hospice, hospice wants to be involved 18 months before the end of your life. As soon as you're diagnosed with an illness that may become life-ending, that's when hospice can be involved, or palliative care teams can be involved to do the control of your pain, the control of your symptoms. Don't wait till you've only got two more days to say, but doctor, I'd like more pain medication. Get care involved earlier. You're less likely to end up in an ICU with somebody putting tubes in you that you'd never want to put in you in the first place, because your family knows what to say. They know to say, no, mom doesn't want that. And I like and don't like the last statement saying decreased cost. The man on life support for 2 years against his will, that wasn't done for nothing. That cost a lot of money. Fine if he could have recovered, or even if he wanted it. He did not want it. It was forced on him and paid for by you. A lot of other people could have been treated with that same money. It wasn't fair, number one, to him. It was not fair to him. And then to ask for the government to pay for that isn't right either. My dad was a colonoscopy. Why pay for a colonoscopy through OHIP if he doesn't want it, if he's not going to do any of the treatments that would be involved afterwards? To get involved with hospice, for all of us, there will be a time when the practical realities of ill health and death intrude on our lives and expectations. You don't have to go through this alone. No one should have to deal with these difficult times alone. Hospice is out there. They can be contacted, just a simple phone call. There's a website there. Look them up in the phone book. They can give you all kinds of resources and help to help you get through difficult times if you should need them. So what's next for you? Figure out who your substitute decision maker is. Remember back to that list of the legally decided substitute decision makers. This is a great little pamphlet that's over there. It's just the quick information about what I've discussed today. There's a big booklet that's much more in depth, but this one just gives you all the highlights, and it gives you that list of who the hierarchy is. If you're okay with who's on that hierarchy to make decisions for you, great. But remember the what ifs. What if that person that would come up first isn't available? Do I like the second choice? Not so much. Get busy and appoint a power of attorney and an alternate. So you can either decide on using the hierarchy or going home and doing a legal power of attorney. And I truly, having worked as a nurse, I really like seeing that power of attorney form come in, because I know that that person was the one that you said is the best person to make decisions for you. Hopefully you weren't Uncle Bob and you actually told the poor guy to use your power of attorney. Complete that little card, that little wallet card, with the name and the alternate of who your substitute decision maker is. Put it in your wallet with your health card. If you go to the hospital, they're going to go through your wallet and they'll find your health card because they want to get paid, and they'll find that card also with your decision maker's name and address or contact information on it. But have the conversation. Talk to these people. Tell them what your wishes, values, and beliefs are, what you need to have decided for you and in what way when it reaches your time. Tons of resources there. If you so desire, there is an evaluation form. If you want any further information, there's contact card for our hospice manager that looks after all of this, whose name is Shelley. We're happy to come out and do presentations anywhere, anytime. If you have groups that you belong to that would like to hear a presentation, then we'll come and do it for you. Questions? And as I say, I'm happy to take questions afterwards. Your questions? Yeah.
First of all, compliments on your comprehensive and engaging presentation.
Thank you.
And I support and I echo your urging to everyone. Make
Good.
Sure you have those two written documents. Make sure they're signed. The power of attorney for property, the power of attorney for personal care. Just to give you a little bit more information about what you mentioned at the beginning, Lynn, and that is that situation where you don't have the time or the opportunity to look for the substitute decision maker. You're at a Ranger game, you're walking around in the hallway in between periods, someone collapses. You're upstairs in church. I've seen it happen at the Catholic church I go to sometimes. Someone passes out right in front of you. You're unable to revive them. What do you do? How many people have had CPR training? Totally recommend you have it. I was at a meeting last week with the New Hamburg Optimist. One of the topics that we discussed was cannabis. I don't want to get into that, talk about confusion. But the second was opiates. So when you think normally of someone passing out or collapsing in front of you, they've had a heart attack or a stroke. What's happening more and more is tremendously prevalent drug overdoses. And that's where often you find out it's an opiate. It could have been heroin. How many people have heard about fentanyl? car fentanyl, that's what they use for elephants. So the situation there is, it's a very difficult one. Hopefully you've had CPR training, or someone in the vicinity has had that CPR training. And what you want to do, you want to try to determine, are there any telltale signs that this is a drug overdose? Is there something called naloxone? Have you heard of that? You can buy it at a pharmacy. Once again, you want to know how to apply naloxone. It's the same thing if you come across someone and you think it's a heart attack, or it's a seizure of some nature other than drugs. The three things I remember is, don't leave the individual. Don't do something you're not trained to do. All of a sudden you start doing this and you're doing it in the wrong fashion. But the most important thing is you phone 911. And this is the situation where you can't revive the person by talking with the person, giving a bit of a shake. You can't wake them up. 911, don't leave the individual. And don't do something you're not trained to do. But with respect to the opiates, every day, on TV, on social media, yeah, the newspapers, you read about another death. And it's not just that homeless person. It's not just that person who has an addiction to drugs. It could be your daughter, your granddaughter, who's experimenting for the first time. And it could be a cigarette. It could be a joint. That's what we used to call them. And somebody's loaded it with fentanyl. Mm-hmm. So that's something I think you want to be aware of. And again, I would encourage all of you to take the CPR training. I've taken it twice. And it's so revealing, and it equips you in such a fashion that you can save a life.
Yeah.
Thanks
very
again.
Good. Thank you. That very good points. And just an aside for that CPR, like it's going to be the person you know. It could be your grandchild falling in the pool. But it's going to be someone you know quite often that you would do. I've done the choking maneuver on my dad. Mm-hmm. He and I were home alone when he obstructed his airway. Like it's good training, excellent training. Questions? Yeah, like I say, I'm happy to hang around after and hear.
Well, on behalf of Zion Phillipsburg Church, Lynn, thank you so much for being able to share your wealth of knowledge. It's something that we all need to think about, whether we want to think about it or not. But as a token of our appreciation, you don't know that Lynn also volunteers at hospice in the gardening, and flower beds at hospice to bring joy to those who are staying at hospice. And so on behalf of Zion, we'd like to give you a little gift card that you can spend to brighten the lives of those that are at hospice.
Great, thank you very much.
You are welcome.